Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
We've got around sort of 10, 12 minutes now before the minister is at least due to arrive. So I'll propose that we take questions based on the opening presentation. So it's really the floor's open to you. I have a few things scribbled down just in case, but hopefully questions will be forthcoming. So if you just want to raise your hands based on anything that's been said that you want to kind of follow up or gain a perspective on, also if you wouldn't mind just standing and saying who you are and which institution you're from. So this is where I take a sharp intake of breath and see who's going to be the first person. Ah, thank you very much, if you wouldn't mind.
Hello, so my name is Mary Phillips.
Sorry, just standing, just for the sake of the camera.
Okay,
thank
Mary
you.
Phillips, formerly of UCL, now working for Academic Analytics. It was very refreshing. This is a comment rather than a question. Very refreshing that Professor McMillan alluded to the fact that the UK has excellence around that circle, not just in the sciences and biomedical sciences, because it seems to me that social science and arts and humanities are absolutely needed to answer the questions that science throws up and to enable us to interpret and move on from those answers.
Thanks very much. So I guess a comment partly on the interrelationship between different subject areas, but I was interested, one of the things I sort of scribbled down, and in some ways it runs contrary to your comment, but, you know, should we be thinking about where the competitive advantage lies, or should we be thinking about what the relationship between different disciplines is? Any other sort of comments or questions before I turn to the panellists? No, well, let me throw one other thing in then, and feel free to kind of carry on thinking if there's anything that you would want to ask. Something that was alluded to but wasn't perhaps touched on directly, but I'd be interested in your perspectives. For institutions that are thinking strategically about research going forward, how would you consider the current climate in terms of potential concerns about UK-based undergraduates thinking about going on into research careers in the UK? Do you think there's enough incentives for talent to either continue in the UK, in UK higher education? And then linked to that, any views on recent changes to visa regulations? I don't just mean, obviously, the story at London Met and how that might impact on the UK's reputation in relation to the recruitment of international talent. But are there kind of growing concerns, perhaps or not, but within your institutions about the extent to which you can feel that you're able to get the best international talent in your institutions? I'll start with Trevor to take either kind of points that have been raised.
Okay. Can I, first of all, thank Mary for her comments. I think this, while we certainly should not be trying to justify social sciences and humanities purely on the basis of what they can do for the sciences, and that is an important trap we can't fall into, the ability to put those together is going to be crucial. I noticed in the paper this morning the nuclear agenda is going to be coming up to some important decision points in the next month or so in government, and unless we get the science linked into the social science to address, for example, the acceptability of what's going forward with the general population, then actually we'll end up back in the mess that we were in the 70s and 80s with the nuclear agenda. Specifically on the postgraduate side, I think at the moment we don't have a serious problem. Inevitably, funding is an issue for PG students. We are still yet clearly to see whether the current change in the undergraduate fee regime will feed through into problems on the postgraduate side. I think for us as institutions, one of the major things we've really got to recognise is that postgraduate training, and in particular PGRs, is not just about training the next generation of academics. That actually we need to give them the skills that actually allow them to go into other sectors, not only for the direct benefit of those sectors, but actually indirectly they will go into those sectors recognising where they can link back into higher education. And where that is happening already, I think those, Luke mentioned the personal networks and things, those personal networks going forward are going to be absolutely crucial. And as universities, we have to recognise that through the effects and good offices of organisations like Vitae, who actually recognise that we have to give our PG students the broad skill base and not purely a disciplinary academic skill base. We all have to respond to and get right. Not always easy for us after the demise of Roberts funding, we have to say. We've all had to address that issue in the last 2 or 3 years, but I think we'll work through it.
Thanks. Nick?
Well, so far we've not seen any reduction. In fact, there's been an increase in the number of undergraduates and master's students from this country who want to go through to postgraduate research. The real issue is getting funds to meet that demand. That's the constraint. And some changes in funding rules around research councils have made it harder to do that. You can't fund them through projects as you used to in the past. So the standard is probably going up as a result of these increased applications. But whether we can really meet future needs is going to be a challenge. I haven't got too much to say around the visa fiasco. Maybe I'll leave it there.
I think that's perhaps all you needed to say. Those two words in some respects say more than you might need to. Yes, any other questions? We'll take the comments at the back and then also the gentleman on my left.
A question from the online audience. Our satellite viewers in at Manchester Metropolitan University, they've asked three questions. Is the independence of universities being comprised due to this collaboration? Sorry, compromised?
Yeah.
Can you produce results that companies don't want to hear if the company has paid for the research? And how do we protect students' intellectual property?
Super, thanks very much. And there was a question just over over there.
Richard Masterman from the University of Nottingham. Trevor McMillan made a comment, I think, at the beginning about one of the distinctive things of the UK's research base was the dual funding system. I just wondered what each speaker's view is on what that contributes to research excellence in the changing research landscape that we have, and why its distinctiveness is important. Thank you.
Thanks very much. So a selection of comments there, and let me perhaps throw one thing in which Luke mentioned, and I think helpful elaboration might be kind of welcomed. You mentioned that there was limited what you described as intersectoral mobility, i.e. between business and higher education. There is seemingly kind of a little bit more interest, certainly from government, to see that stimulated. What in practice do you think that institutions such as your own and others could be doing to sort of perhaps act more actively facilitate that? I think there's a broad acceptance of what the benefits might be, but you know, why is it that you think there, you know, mobility is as stunted as it is? I'll start with Luke, if you want to pick up on some of those comments that have been raised.
Okay, well, maybe I should start on that last one then. It's something which everyone agrees would be a good idea and we'd all like to do more of. It really tends to fall down in the practicalities. It's relatively easy for academics to go and work in business, at least in certain environments, no problem at all in an R&D environment, for example. It's business people coming the other way is more difficult. I mean, they're practical issues around salaries and pensions. Their issues around what they want to do. They're all very happy to come and do research. They're less happy to face doing the extensive kind of teaching that an academic might have to deliver. And then maybe linking to the coming theme in this conference, it's also difficult to construct a ref entry for somebody who's coming from an environment where publication is not a major objective.
Trevor, do you want to pick up on any of the comments?
Only on that one. I guess, Luke's absolutely right. My understanding is lots of universities have set up schemes to try and facilitate this and really struggled. The answer is probably, again, around those networks and actually short-term mobility and interaction at that level rather than the full movement of staff from one sector into another. Exactly how that's done and on what basis is not very clear, but it will be around the issue of creating those personal interactions rather than necessarily project-based of people doing specific things as they move between the two.
In relation to one of the points that was raised from colleagues at Manchester Met, I mean, perhaps, do you want to say what steps Lancaster is able to take to protect the intellectual property of researchers, research students at Lancaster, and potentially how that might sort of and then linked into some of the comments about the steps that an institution might need to take in order for gold access to become the norm and what the practical implications you feel might be for institutions such as yours, and whether, not necessarily whether you think you're part of the 30, but, you know, what support do you feel you might be entitled to get or might need to get?
Yeah, I think that's a tricky one, and Lancaster, because we don't have big medical school, don't have big engineering, might not be the best example of things emerging in that area. I think the system is there to protect IP if you recognise what the IP is that you want to protect. The difficulty is the early stages and the breadth of access and the work that needs to go in order to deliver that access if needed. It's not simply a matter of posting something on a web and hoping somebody will find it if they really want it. We don't see it as a huge issue. Maybe there's something specific at Manchester Met that they're worried about. But we do seem to be able to get our students through in a way that actually does allow them to express their ingenuity and entrepreneurship in a way that benefits them going forward. The broader issue of open access, I think, is very tricky. First of all, on the data side, the lodging, the storage, and more importantly, the indexing of data is critical. But there are big cultural issues that sit behind that. So while the IT technical people can get through some of those technical sides of things, the cultural issues of knowing what actually should be stored, because we shouldn't be storing everything. So what should be stored? And that is going to take a lot going through. There are some, though, big technical issues. My previous boss used to say that the only consistent mode of transmission of information in 30 years' time compared with now is probably hieroglyphics. I suspect that many of us have got 3.5-inch disks sitting in our cupboards with lots of important data on them that we have no chance of accessing, certainly with the machines that we currently have on our desk. So there's lots of issues there to work through.
And Luke, perhaps a brief comment on the importance of, or as you see it, of the dual route of funding.
Well, I'm sure anyone in a university would say that this is absolutely critical, because it creates the headroom that allows us to have research strategies which are not purely responsive to annual lines of funding. They also pay for a lot of infrastructural activities, and critically for the time, or a large chunk of the time, that our academics are spending on research. I mean, it's a bit of a clunky system to operate, and we're here talking about the REF and so on, but in the end, it's a brilliant creation, and we need to fight to preserve it.
Any final comments or questions? Yes, we've got a gentleman, fourth row or so.
Peter Senchenko at the University of Southampton. I quite enjoyed Professor Macmillan's African proverb: if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I think it was last year or around about that timescale that we heard that the universities of Birmingham and Nottingham had agreed to work much more closely together. I wonder if the panel be prepared to look into their crystal balls in 10 years' time and describe what they see in terms of the research landscape in this country.
Fascinating. Any other comments or questions before I turn to the panellists? Well, I have one thing that I think is going to be an equally, I won't say unfair question, but challenging question, which is, you know, we've got the minister, well, theoretically at least, coming in any second now, whether he might be in earshot or not. Thinking about what you would want to hear from government in relation to research and supporting UK research, is there any, you know, one thing or a couple of priorities that you would want to hear from government on top of what's been previously announced by this government to date? I'll start with Trevor.
Okay. On the first of those, Luke and I are both part of a collaboration known as the N8. In the north of England, and Diana at the front from Liverpool is part of that. And I think I would see that those sorts of collaborations actually being a much more important part of the landscape going forward. They're not easy to put together. I have to say it's taken us as a group of eight universities, largely working at Pro Vice Chancellor for Research level, something like 5 or 6 years to build up a trust between us, where on the one hand we can recognise that we can do things well together, but on the other hand recognise that sometimes we have to step back and let other people take the lead in the recognition that maybe we'll get the lead next time. So there's lots going on there. It's actually working through very well at all sorts of levels. Very interesting discussions going on around sharing equipment at the moment. Some very interesting projects going on right across humanities, social sciences, specific areas of science and technology, and in particular in terms of our interface with industry. So some interesting projects that I would urge you to have a look at. Whether they will ever become formally cast in stone or whether they will be the sorts of groupings that end up being fluid with people coming in, moving out, I think we have to wait and see. But the only thing that I would emphasise again is that it's about relationships and it's about those trusts, and they're not easy.
Well, I certainly echo what Trevor said, that the N8 has proved a valuable alliance for us. I suppose the ultimate step we took in that direction was the merger between the Victoria University of Manchester and UMIST. This is responding to similar pressures. Size does give you advantages. It's not so much economies of scale as economies of scope, and that really comes forward when you're trying to work on business or societal problems where you have to configure several disciplines together to get the teams that you need. You can do that internally, but there comes a point where you can't, and that's where alliances come in, that you can find the grouping of skills that allows you to address those problems. And the collaboration will remain, I'm sure, an important part of the research landscape.
And just to, I mean, I'll come on to the second part of the question in a second, but just on that point, do you perhaps anticipate that the way in which market forces are playing a greater role in the distribution of undergraduate student numbers and potentially, and certainly Trevor alluded to this, the viability of certain departments being able to reach a kind of critical mass of numbers, do you anticipate that, I'm not necessarily saying in the Northwest, but allowing you to sort of look at the distribution of higher education in England or indeed across the UK, that there may need to be more institutions, or you feel that they might want to look a little more closely at collaborations, whether that's formally merger or just the way in which departments are working together at kind of local level?
I think if you took an Olympian view of some subjects, you wouldn't design the way they're distributed around the country as it is now. There's clearly scope for rationalisation. Funding Council doesn't see this as part of their job, and it's rather harder to do this in a bottom-up way, but I'm sure it will happen.
Yeah. And then on the sort of second part of the question, if you choose to, you know, he may be just out the door, I hope he is. Is there something you would want to hear from government that would make your jobs, not just in the short term, but over the medium and longer term, a great deal easier, aside from the one thing you can't say is just more money, so... anything else?
As well as not.
Yeah.
As well as more money.
Yeah.
I, in many respects, I think keep keep going. My single statement would be don't try to micromanage.
Okay. Luke?
Yeah, well, I'd certainly echo what Trevor just said and expect some of our funding bodies to understand that universities are good at strategic integration and allow us to do that. I don't think we can go away from the money issue because we're coming up to a spending review, and it's not a matter of holding the slipping ground that we have. We really should go forward and say we need a big advance. We need to bring capital into the ring fence so that we can do things efficiently, and we need to really combine together to make a strong case.
Great. I've received a reassuring text to say he's at the front door, so I presume that means downstairs. So that there's time for one final comment or question, which if anyone would like to make it, or is no one going to be no one wants to take that opportunity, that's fine. Let me just think of sort of one quick question then, just to hold before David Willetts arrives. I mean, how much emphasis are you playing on the kind of commercialization of the research that you undertake in your institutions, and to what extent do you feel there is forthcoming support for particularly, you know, young researchers in or indeed other staff in relation to that? Trevor, I don't know if you want to start.
Yeah, I think for us it's clearly important, and I would use the impact word rather than the commercialization word, because again that allows us to recognise that it's an issue right across the whole university disciplinary base and not just in the obvious science and engineering areas. It's important that we do support all our staff and young staff to actually engage with that, and I think we're doing that in various ways. Getting the balance right is tricky, but I think we are getting more mature in our views of that impact. I suspect 10 or 15 years ago, a lot of it was based on, for example, spin-out companies, which in many respects, I could argue, are almost like buying a ticket in the lottery in terms of their certainly impact on university finances. We can all quote the big winners, but mostly it's chugging away and at a fairly low level. So the whole impact agenda, I think, is key, and it comes back to what I was saying in my talk about REF being an important mode by which the behaviour of researchers and institutions in the UK are actually determined.
I'll turn very briefly to Luke and then introduce or invite the Minister to speak. Just on top of that sort of question, linked, I mean, I was struck by the comparisons that you were able to make between Manchester and MIT and perhaps something about the way in which students are encouraged to think about entrepreneurship and what that does for their destinations afterwards in terms of spin-outs, not so much the institution. Kind of further reflections on that, Luke.
Sure. Well, that fits with the answer I was going to give to your commercialisation question. It is important that we do it. I said it's exciting, it's romantic, but as a source of revenue, it's pretty small. It's like a couple of percent for even the universities that are very active in it. But what it does do is provide a flagship for a sort of culture of enterprise. And if we were not pushing in these directions, it would be very hard for us to help train the students in those directions. And we're now increasingly using the same infrastructures to help the students in those respects. So the people who are in these companies, the people who advise these companies, are also providing hands-on training for students. We've just opened a walk-in centre for where students can go and get help with ideas for knowledge-based service companies. One of the Dragon's Den people is sponsoring it. So a lot going on, but more growth, I think, needed.
Thanks very much to both of you. If you wouldn't mind just thanking them in the usual way, I think it's been a really helpful start to the conference.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.